Alabama has a new face in its quarterback competition, but is he any better than the options we saw on A-Day? On the NFL draft front, Alabama and Georgia tied for the most NFL draft picks with 10 apiece, and the SEC is considering tightening the screws to curtail fans storming the field. We'll get into all that today on SEC Football Unfiltered, our podcast from the USA Today Network. I'm Blake Topmeyer, joined as always by John Adams. And John, we teased it last week with the transfer portal window sort of winding down. It is now closed. We got our last flurry of activity, and Alabama has itself a new quarterback in its competition, which currently stands five scholarship quarterbacks deep. But do they have a crown jewel among them? Remains to be seen. Crimson Tide picked up Notre Dame backup quarterback Tyler Buckner last week. He'll transfer in and join a competition headlined by Jalen Milroe and Ty Simpson. And I think the initial reaction to this, John, was, okay, Alabama's got its new starting quarterback. But my response to that is, well, if Tyler Buckner was so good, why did Notre Dame bring in Sam Hartman to be its starter? Why is Tyler Buckner transferring from Notre Dame? Well, he's transferring because he was going to be the backup at Notre Dame. And I have a hard time seeing Alabama's answer being a Notre Dame backup. What's your reaction to this this last round of transfer activity headlined by the Alabama move?
Might as well fly a plane over Tuscaloosa with a banner hanging that reads, "We need help at QB." Pretty obvious. Nick Saban is saying, "We're not set here, quarterback. We got issues. We got to bring in somebody else." I can't imagine Buckner transferring there unless he thought he was going to be the quarterback. Now, he may not be, but based on what happened in spring practice, Alabama's guys, Ty Simpson and the likely starter, Jalen Milroe, weren't impressive enough. Their spring game stats certainly weren't dazzling. So, yeah, this is kind of, to me, a desperation move. Now, maybe it'll work out, but my question is kind of why couldn't Alabama get Sam Hartman?
Yeah, that's a good point, John. Like, the better Notre Dame quarterback is the one still at Notre Dame, and you know, one of the subplots of this move is Tyler Buckner reuniting with Tommy Rees, his old offensive coordinator at Notre Dame. Well, Tommy Rees was still employed by Notre Dame when they went out and brought in Sam Hartman from Wake Forest. So that clearly tells you that Notre Dame was not fully confident in Buckner being its starter, that it thought Sam Hartman was an upgrade. And you mentioned the spring game stats from Alabama's in-house options there, Jalen Milroe and Ty Simpson. They were pretty inconsistency. I thought they both flashed some ability, but they didn't put it together play to play. I thought Jalen Milroe was the better of the two. Certainly showed off his big arm and his athleticism, his running ability, but he also made some mistakes through an interception and was not as efficient as he needed to be. But then you look at what Buckner did in Notre Dame's spring game, John, and, well, here's the stat line. He threw 18 passes. He completed 8 of them for 44 yards with an interception. There's your grand solution to your quarterback woes as a guy who was 8 of 18 for 44 yards in the spring game. And, you know, we could look back on that shootout of a bowl game with South Carolina, in which Buckner was the starting quarterback. Notre Dame won that game. He threw for a lot of yards, but he also threw for 3 interceptions, including 2 pick sixes. And what have we heard Nick Saban say throughout the spring? He's looking for guys who can play winning football. And I think at quarterback, in Sabanese, that loosely translates to quarterbacks who can be efficient, and steer the team away from mistakes. Eliminate miscues, don't commit turnovers. Well, that didn't describe Tyler Buckner at Notre Dame. He only completed about 55% of his passes in an injury-interrupted season last year. He threw 5 interceptions on just 83 attempts all season, and like I said, he had 3 picks against South Carolina. So I don't know that he fits the mold of efficient, mistake-free type quarterback, and so in lieu of that, I still have a hard time seeing how Jalen Milroe is not the best of these five options.
It's puzzling, admittedly. It really points out how important it is to manage that position from a personnel perspective. If you come up short at quarterback now and you're trying to win a championship, you're in big trouble. It's just you talk about Nick Saban wants a quarterback who's efficient, doesn't make mistakes, doesn't make turnovers. Well, you also need a playmaker. You need the combination. The old caretaker, game manager type quarterback doesn't lead you to a national championship anymore. Greg McElroy comes to mind. So it looks like Alabama's really settling, and Alabama's not accustomed to settling. You've got all these quarterbacks. See, I still think Jalen Milroe might win that job.
Yeah, and it's concerning to me that, you know, Alabama and Nick Saban must think so little of Jalen Milroe and Ty Simpson that he needs to add another option. And it's also concerning to me that Tommy Reese apparently has not developed either of these guys to the point where they're ready to hand the reins to them to be the starting quarterback. I mean, you know, we saw Jalen Milroe win a start against Texas A&M at home last year. That game hung in the balance. Texas A&M very easily could have won that game. And Jalen Milroe was responsible for, I believe, his three turnovers in that game. He has to be more secure with the football. This is not a polished product. We've talked about that throughout the spring. However, anytime you see him on the field, you can see the ability. I mean, in Alabama's spring game just a couple weeks ago, there's a lot of talented, quick athletes on that roster. And on a 35-yard touchdown run that Jalen Milroe kept and raced into the end zone, he was the fastest guy on the field. And then there would be a lot of fields he'd be on where he'd be the fastest guy on the field. I mean, that's why you brought Tommy Reese in, right? Was to be a quarterback developer. Sure, run your offense, yes, but that starts with developing the next quarterback. And he's had a spring to work with these guys, and apparently he's not got either of them, being Jalen Milroe or Ty Simpson, to the point where Nick Saban would feel comfortable with them and not needing a transfer. I mean, there's something to be said for improving your depth of options. I get that. You know, if this is just throw another log on the fire, add another body to the mix and see what spits out in September, fine. But I don't really see how the competition has been improved all that much, and I don't really see how this is an overly encouraging sign that at this juncture of the calendar, Alabama would think it would need a fresh face to its competition. That obviously tells us that that neither Jalen Milroe or Ty Simpson are where they need to be. And the question is why? Why can't these guys be developed? Why can't a quarterback who's as talented as Jalen Milroe be polished up a little bit to where Alabama thinks it can play winning football with him at the position?
Well, to me, this is a Tommy Reese move. He knows he's been through a spring now with Jalen Milroe and Tyler Simpson, and he's telling Nick Saban, a player at Notre Dame that he coached, you had to have this conversation. And Nick Saban says, who's better? Who would you rather have at quarterback? Because you've got a working knowledge of all these guys, and Tommy Reese has obviously said, Ty Buckner, I would rather have him as our quarterback. So while I wouldn't be surprised if Milroe became the quarterback, Alabama's clearly thinking that it won't be Milroe, that it will be Ty Buckner based on what the coach had. It goes back to – think back to a couple of years ago, Josh Heupel's first season here in Tennessee. He brings in after spring practice, he adds a transfer, Joe Milton from Michigan, a guy who started some but lost his job. Brings him in after spring football, a clear indicator that he wasn't satisfied with the quarterbacks he had. And Joe Milton started the first two games, then was replaced by Hendon Hooker, and the rest is history. Hendon Hooker became a star. So he didn't have a working knowledge of Milton, but he made the determination that we still needed. He said he still needed a quarterback upgrade. Turned out he didn't, but
yeah, that's the thing. Sometimes these coaches, you know, we think they're going to settle on the right guy in the end. It's not always the case, and it's a good example with Tennessee there, and Joe Milton suffered an injury early in that 2021 season, and Hendon Hooker took the baton, and it was lights out. After that, it was his job, and Josh Heupel, to his credit, you know, did not dig his heels in and try to go back to Milton. He realized that he'd made the wrong choice out of the gates, and Hooker should have been the guy all along, and he was the guy after that. But it does, you know, I think it's so easy when these transfer quarterbacks come in that we suddenly think like, well, coach knows best. This is going to be an upgrade at the position. I mean, that's not always the case. We saw it at Georgia. You know, JT Daniels came in with tons of buzz and hype, and ultimately he was not the man for that job. Stetson Bennett was the man for that job. You noted the Hendon Hooker Joe Milton situation, and Joe Milton is now in line to be Tennessee's starter. So he was still a good add in the long term for Tennessee, but the best starter that they had was an in-house option. And so I don't necessarily think, I'm kind of with you, I don't necessarily think that just because Buckner is here, he's going to win the job. I think it could still shake out to be Milroe. And I think, you know, when we look at Ole Miss, you know, despite the fact that they brought in two transfer quarterbacks and Spencer Sanders and Walker Howard, Jackson Dart's still there. He didn't transfer out. Jackson Dart obviously still believes he can win that job, and I wouldn't rule him out. And I do think that we're starting to see that some with the transfer portal is coaches, yeah, sometimes they want to go out and get their next starter at a certain position. Other times, if they're not totally decided on their options at that spot, they say, hey, we'll add another face here and let the best man win, whoever that may be.
Well, you bring up Stetson Bennett at Georgia. That's a great example of you can't – it's not that easy to evaluate these quarterbacks. And I think coaches analyze every day and video every move those guys make in practice. But it doesn't account for how a player might perform in a game always. You play like you practice. Coaches say that, but we see differently when we watch games. And we see a guy who rises to the occasion. Stetson Bennett, there's no better example of that. Georgia repeatedly, seemingly recruited over him. Again and again. I mean, they wanted him to just go away so we can put a top-notch quarterback in there. Turns out it had a top-notch college quarterback. You couldn't play any better under pressure than he did. And what was he drafted? But other people now see that a little bit. I think when he drafted in the fourth round by the Rams. So who would have thought? I go back to watching Stetson Bennett his first year as a starter. The first time I saw him, and I thought, this guy can't play. He's not an SEC quarterback. Well, now he might be an NFL quarterback. So you think at the most important position that you can evaluate these guys, and all the experts can weigh in, and they can come up with who's the number one guy, but they can't. I mean, that's why Tom Brady was a number six-round draft pick, and now he's the greatest of all time. So it's tricky, But Blake, it's so important. You go back to the signing of Ty Simpson a couple of years ago. He's a five-star. That was Alabama's. When you sign a five-star at Alabama, that's apparently going to be your guy for the future. I mean, that's how you got Bryce Young. He turned out pretty good. You sign these kind of guys, and that's supposed to be the future. But the fact that he can't win that job tells me, well, you missed on that one.
And sometimes that happens. You look back over the years, these five-star quarterbacks, they don't hit 100%. You know, you'd rather sign the five-star guy than the two-star guy. There's no question about that. But they don't bat 1,000. And you look at Tyler Buckner's recruiting profile. He was a top 100 recruit when he signed with Notre Dame, wasn't quite a five-star, but was just shy of that in the 24/7 sports composite. So he was, you know, he was a highly sought after recruit. But you look at the production, you know, across two seasons, he played some in 2021. You know, he played some last year around an injury. and he's thrown 118 passes in his career, and six of them have been intercepted. You know, that's a rate of about once every 20 passes he's thrown a pick. That just does not sound like Alabama winning football to me. And the other thing you mentioned, you know, quarterbacks can be tough to evaluate and practice. I think with Jalen Milroe, now, I mean, Nick Saban's got a long look at him in the program. He's been around for a couple years now. But I think those dual threat running quarterbacks, you know, you're not taking live hits in practice. You know, you get the no contact jersey on, defenders can't lay a hand on you unless they get a butt chewing from the coaching staff for roughing up the quarterback. And I think it can be hard to evaluate those types of quarterbacks in practice because so much of what they do is with their legs, right? And they threaten defenses in multiple ways. But when you're in practice, you know, you're not really running around a ton in your no contact jersey and two hand touch football and the play is dead. It's just, it does make those quarterbacks, I think, a little bit tougher to evaluate. I guess the bottom line for me, John, is I don't know that we've seen anything from Ty Simpson to make me think he can win this job. So I guess if this is resetting the table with Jalen Milroe and Tyler Buchner at the top of the competition, okay, that's fine. So be it, you know, fresh face for the battle. But I think my final thought is I don't know that they've improved their top end option. I still think Jalen Milroe is probably the best candidate that Alabama has for that job.
Well, let's take another example. Now, Anthony Richardson was a highly recruited player and went to Florida, but how did he first impress us? It was running like a 400 meter Olympian. He just, you know, play breaks down. He just takes off. He outruns everybody on the field. You mentioned Milroe in the spring game, looked like the fastest guy on the field. Well, that's how Anthony Richardson first impressed us. And then he developed and now became a top five. He only really started one full season and he became a top five draft pick. So there is potential with these guys. Now, some guys don't develop. It's not all on coaching. Some guys just don't fine-tune their games, but it does happen. We talked last week about KJ Jefferson of Arkansas. Now, to me, he's gotten better. But how did he first impress me? By running over a linebacker. But his passing skill is he has a nice touch on the deep ball. Those have improved. So you pointed out, and I think we're both fans of dual threat quarterbacks because there's so much potential there. When you have a quarterback who can run 70 yards for a touchdown, it's quite a game changer.
Yeah. And if you can add a guy to the competition and not lose anybody in the process, fine. The more the merrier. But let the best man win, and it remains to be seen who that best man is at Alabama. You mentioned the draft, John. Let's segue in that direction. It was an SEC party, as expected, throughout the three-day draft in Kansas City. Right from the get-go, Alabama pumped Bryce Young, number one overall, to the Panthers. A couple picks later, Will Anderson was going to the Texans, and Alabama and Georgia led the way with 10 draft picks apiece. So often, John, especially in recent years, the NFL draft is a coronation of the team that won the national championship. We saw that after LSU won the title in 2019. They smashed it in the draft the following spring. Same thing was true for Alabama's 2020 team. Same thing was true for Georgia's 2021 team. But it is interesting that in this draft, Alabama and Georgia tied with the most draft picks. Of course, Georgia now is the two-time defending champion, but Alabama did not make the college football playoff despite having 10 draft picks, despite having 8 of those draft picks go in the first 3 rounds. It's one of the best draft classes Nick Saban has produced, and yet it must feel a little bit bittersweet to know Alabama possessed all that NFL talent, including the number one overall quarterback, and was not able to get to the college football playoff this year.
that is usually a great indicator of what kind of season you had with your draft picks. But every now and then there'll be teams. I can remember it was many years ago, but I just remember a Purdue team once. I think it had 8 guys drafted. Very mediocre season. So there are always outliers in that deal. But I think with Alabama, it's been so good for so long, and then you have all of a sudden you have this many guys drafted, so you assume this was another championship class or at least a playoff team, and it was neither. So, yeah, that's got to really bother Alabama fans. So it's as though this team didn't play up to its potential. That's what it comes down to. It wasn't as good as it was supposed to be. And I can remember Alabama had 2 safeties drafted. You go back and look at the video of that Tennessee-Alabama game where Tennessee scored 52 points. And those 2 safeties didn't look like future NFL players. And we talked about this before, but the fact that Alabama was plagued by mistakes, penalties, turnovers, those kind of things, it just didn't measure up. And I would think that bothers Nick Saban more than anybody. And I would think this next team, I think he will be very determined to make sure guys don't do the little things wrong and to turn that around. That's just not what we're accustomed to seeing from Alabama football or Nick Saban football.
And I think that might be why we continue to hear this persistent battle cry throughout the offseason of Nick Saban saying, we're looking for guys who play winning football. Because if you're looking for an explanation for how did a team that had 10 draft picks, 8 of whom were selected in the first 3 rounds, how did a team with that much talent not make the college football playoff? Well, you still have to play quote-unquote winning football. Nick Saban built this dynasty on the back of being a disciplined program. Well, there was nothing disciplined about Alabama last year. They were one of the most penalized teams in the nation. They had a negative turnover differential. They lost their sizzle on special teams that they had become known for, you know, during the early days of the Saban dynasty. So even though there was a lot of individual talent and Bryce Young was sensational throughout 2 seasons, I really think if they would have had a different, really almost any other quarterback in that program the last 2 years, they would have lost more than the 4 games that they did over that 2-year stretch. And I thought that was reflected in Bryce Young going number 1 overall to the Panthers. But despite all that talent, you have to still play disciplined football. And that just wasn't real common in Tuscaloosa the past 2 seasons, particularly this past year when they had some heavily penalized games. You look at that loss to Tennessee, 17 penalties. They lost in overtime against LSU, 9 penalties. These are penalty counts that were not common for Saban's teams, you know, really throughout most of this run, and particularly, you know, during the early years when this dynasty was going. So when we talk about, you know, there's so much talk this offseason about Alabama getting back to bully ball, getting back to old school Alabama. Old school Alabama has to mean more than just handing the ball off 50 times a game, right? Like it has to also involve those robust defenses, those efficient quarterbacks, and those teams that eliminate mistakes. They don't commit a ton of penalties. They don't commit a ton of turnovers. That would really be getting back to vintage Alabama.
Yeah, and let's look at Alabama's most recent national championship team. It was just back in 2020. That wasn't bully ball. That was a pass-happy offense, just piling up the points and outscoring everybody. Tremendous talent at wide receiver. Najee Harris running the ball. yeah, it was overwhelming offensive talent. So the idea of going back to bully ball and grind out 3 and 4 yards and control the ball and play super defense, you don't win a national championship with that. You could say Georgia did that. It relied on a running game, was 4 or 5 deep in running backs, had a pretty good offensive line and a great defense. But when it came down to it this past season, why did it win those big crucial games? It won with Stetson Bennett making plays at quarterback. So you got to have it all now. You don't want to be turning the ball over and getting silly penalties. But you also have to have a playmaker. So you can't just secure the ball and win games, or not make any penalties and win big games. It's a combination. So,
yeah, and you look back on that 2020 team, for as exciting as they were on offense, they also won the turnover margin, and they also were not very highly penalized. So you're right. It does take all the pieces. On the Georgia front, John, this was not quite the coronation that last year's draft was when they set a record with 15 draft picks, and it's like every time you looked up, there was a new Georgia player putting on a ball cap and shaking Roger Goodell's hand. You know, they had three guys go in the first round, headlined by Jalen Carter going number 9 overall to the Eagles. But they didn't put as many guys in the first three rounds as Alabama did. They matched the overall total. But I think for me, this draft really hammered home what a great coaching job Kirby Smart did this past season. And he lost the 15 draft picks from a year before. And in a very Saban-like fashion, he didn't skip a beat. And even though this team was maybe not as talented, I think we can eliminate the maybe. I don't think this past team was as talented as his 2021 national championship team. And I think the draft backed that up. And some of the top talent maybe on this past Georgia team was younger talent that we're going to see drafted in years to come. But I really thought that... you know, if we're looking for draft takeaways, it was Georgia, while it still had a lot of veteran talent last year, didn't have as much as it had the year prior. And to me, this hammers home what a great coaching job Kirby Smart did in winning back-to-back titles. You know, even though his top-end veteran talent decreased year over year.
Yeah, that's also a testament to his recruiting. Like Alabama and Nick Saban, Kirby Smart's Georgia program has repeatedly produced top three recruiting classes. But you can't just recruit that well. To win a championship, you have to develop these guys. And what's really impressive to me is how well Georgia is developing these 4 and 5 stars. It doesn't seem as though it's missing on a lot of guys. They just keep coming. And when Alabama was at the top of its game, it did the same thing. You would see one of these 4 or 5 stars come in late in a game, and the game was already decided. But you see those guys make a play or two and think, oh, boy, he's going to be something, too, once he gets on the field. And you saw that with Georgia. You pointed it out last year. Maybe not as many veteran stars, but there's some young stars on that team, and you can see those guys becoming forces this year and even the year after.
Yeah, and Georgia, quite obviously, alongside Alabama, are going to remain forces in the NFL draft for years to come. A couple other draft observations, John. I thought it was notable Tennessee had 5 draft picks, all of whom went in the first 3 rounds, including Hendon Hooker, going in the 3rd round to the Detroit Lions. You know, for years, Tennessee performed pretty well in the recruiting rankings. They would sign top 10, top 15 type recruiting classes. But then you looked at the draft every spring, and there was a long stretch where Tennessee was just not being represented all that well, about a decade stretch where it wasn't pumping out a ton of draft picks, certainly not in the first couple rounds. And then, you know, I think this is a feather in the cap of the way Josh Heupel's come in and developed talent. The fact that he was able to pump out 5 draft picks in the first 3 rounds, that's really outperforming what Tennessee has done throughout the past decade. And then the other observation I had, John, LSU sent 6 draft picks to NFL teams. That's a solid number, but I think that's a far cry of what LSU is capable of. And the fact that Brian Kelly won the West, got to Atlanta in his first season with that number of draft picks. Again, for a lot of programs, 6 draft picks is a really good number. For LSU, that's the type of program that can have double-digit NFL talent in a draft class. And we've talked about how that program seems to just be scratching the surface under Brian Kelly, and we discussed the transfer portal earlier. It is worth noting that as the portal closes, LSU has hung on to both of its quarterbacks in Jaden Daniels and Garrett Nussmeier. Nussmeier, the very talented backup, who will have 2 years of eligibility remaining after this season. So he can spend one more year as LSU's backup, and then he'll have 2 years to presumably be the starter. So I think the future is undeniably bright at LSU.
Yeah, you could put those two programs together in a way. Tennessee certainly didn't enjoy the success LSU did in recent years, but fairly new coaches. Josh Heupel finished his second season, Brian Kelly just one season. Both of those coaches have made tremendous turnarounds. People forget that Josh Heupel lost about 10 starters when he came in here. They transferred out after the Jeremy Pruitt era crashed and burned. They were out of here. He lost all that talent and still won 7 games the next year, and then became a top 10 team in 2022. You look at some of these players, they appear to be maybe highly recruited, but they were falling by the wayside, and they flourished under Josh Heupel. Brian Kelly, I think he did a great job bringing in transfers, kind of cobbling together a solid team around talent that, as the draft indicated, wasn't super. But to win the SEC West, that's a tremendous accomplishment right there, because that means you had to beat out Alabama. And that's no matter – even if Alabama was off its game a notch, it's still Alabama, and winning that means so much. Beating Alabama and then winning that division. I think both of those programs, too, are very active with NIL. I think they have a really solid collective, and they're not being outbid a lot. So that's a good sign for both of those programs going forward, is good coaches and coaches who see the big picture, combining good recruiting and bringing in quality transfers as well. So I think both of those fan bases can be very excited about where their programs are headed.
John, aside from the NFL draft and the transfer carousel, I guess one of the big news items of the past week as it pertains to the SEC was a report from Sports Illustrated's Pat Forty that touched on the workings of this this group that Greg Sankey had assembled to take a look at how the SEC can further curtail the field stormings and the court stormings. Of course, there was a couple of high-profile field stormings last year involving Alabama, Tennessee beating Alabama for the first time since 2006. As you'd expect, there was a raucous field storming scene there that involved one of Alabama's players, Jermaine Burton, reaching his hand out and making contact with a college female as she rushed onto the field, and that incident got a lot of coverage. Although Burton was not suspended for it, and so it was around that time the SEC said it was going to take a look and form a working group on how it could get its hands around these court stormings and field stormings. And according to the Sports Illustrated report, there are the members of this working group, which involves the athletics directors from Alabama, Kentucky, and Georgia, are weighing some different options, including the possibility of, if you storm the field after beating a team, you would take the next time you're supposed to host that team, the next home game would then become a road game. So in this instance, you know, we're talking about with Tennessee, they beat Alabama last fall, the 2022 season. They're set to host Alabama again in 2024. If this drastic measure gains approval, well, that scheduled home game between Tennessee and Alabama in 2024 would become a road game in Tuscaloosa. We don't know where this is going to go. You would need to approve this, you know, around the league's chancellors and presidents. But I have a hard time seeing, John, a measure being this drastic being approved. I just don't know if school officials are going to be okay with saying, yeah, we'll turn a home game into a road game if our fans storm the court or storm the field after a game. Because I mean, are they going to feel confident enough that they can keep 100,000 fans off the field, and including some drunk college students? You're going to be able to keep them off the field? What if 20 students spill onto the field after a game? You know, are you going to have a home game turned into a road game 2 years down the road? I have a hard time seeing them getting a majority of the schools in this conference to agree to such provisions. What do you think?
I look at this two ways. There is an inherent danger in storming the field. There's no doubt about it. Also, there's the fun factor. There's a lot of fun for college students to rush out on the field, take down goalposts, and as Tennessee fans did last season, deposit the goalpost in the Tennessee River. I mean, that was beating Alabama was a big deal, but throwing those goalposts in the river was just about as newsworthy. And I think Tennessee fans, by doing that, got so much publicity that sort of became the hallmark for field storming. And other fan bases looked at this, man, those guys are having fun. They don't look, college students, particularly those who have been drinking, and that does happen at college football games.
No. Yeah, nobody's drinking at the games, John, are they?
Yeah, I have a couple of beers. I mean, can you eliminate all risk, and can you control all these people rushing out there? I don't think it's possible. What I would do, I would try and minimize the chaos. And I would have each school could designate a game every 2 years when its fans can storm the field.
If you win this one, you get to storm. If you don't, no storming this year, huh?
Yes. Yeah, so say Tennessee fans could go back in 2024. They could say, okay, if we beat Alabama in Neyland Stadium, the fans can storm the field. You have extra security for those games and try and minimize the number of participants in the field storming. And you also, hope for the best that there's no major incident. I just don't know. Here's the thing too. You don't see Alabama and Georgia fans aren't storming the field. They expect to win. I don't think Tennessee, the next time it beats Alabama, will need to storm the field. I thought it was really lame when LSU beat Alabama and fans ran onto the field. I mean, LSU just won a national title with a tremendous team, unbeaten team in 2019. So it's not as though beating Alabama signifies the high mark of the program. It's done it before.
John, LSU fans rushed the field after beating Ole Miss. LSU fans just love rushing the field. They don't need much excuse to rush the field. And I get the appeal of it. I don't know if it would be something I would have done as a college student. I went to a Division II school. We weren't rushing the field. First of all, Truman State wasn't winning that many football games while I was there. Second of all, I don't know if you could have corralled 100 students at the game to rush the field with. So I don't know if it's something I would have done or not done, but I do get the rush, the appeal of it. You know, I've been on the field in one of those situations. I don't know that I feared for my safety in that moment, but I wasn't on the field. I was in the press box the moment the initial wave occurred, and then I was down on the field trying to wade my way through the bodies to get to the press conference afterwards. I've done that, had to do that a couple times, and I've not been afraid for my safety at those points, but I can see where during that initial rush, it can be dangerous during the moment where the goalposts come down. I mean, we're not talking about foam goalposts here. That can be dangerous. No question. The crowd surge, people getting pinned up against walls and railings and barriers, that can all be very dangerous. I get both sides of the equation here. Not to mention for the opposing team, you know, we saw an interaction just this past year between a fan and a player. Now, you know, Jermaine Burton was initiating that incident there, and video of the incident. There seemed to be no reason why he couldn't have just continued on to the locker room without striking that co-ed in the head. But nonetheless, when fans and players are sharing a space together after a heated game, a heated event, you do run the risk of incidents occurring. So I understand maybe the desire to try to roll this back a little bit. I do think the quiet unspoken part is that it's kind of a good recruiting tool for the conference too, to see these joyous moments, you know, unfold. But I could see a desire to roll this back somewhat. And it doesn't surprise me that, you know, this working group would include members from Alabama, Kentucky, and Georgia, right? Like, who's the recipient of field stormings, of court stormings? Who's in danger of this? Well, Alabama football, anytime they lose, they're in danger of a field storming. Georgia has built itself to the point to where if they ever lost to anybody, they'd be in danger of a field storming. And Kentucky basketball, of course, they're always in danger of court stormings. So, yeah, those schools, I could see where they're not doing a lot of rushing of the field. You know, if you're an Alabama fan and you win a football game, you're not rushing the field because you're Alabama. You expect to win, right? So for schools like that, I could see where curtailing these field stormings, these court stormings, would be very appealing. I think it's going to be a hard sell to some other schools, though, that would worry about their ability, you know, to keep fans off the field at all costs and would hate the thought of losing a home game and having that become a road game 2 years down the road if it were to, despite their best efforts, fans wind up on the field.
Well, you have to refer back to the SEC slogan. The SEC just means more. More wins, more draft picks, more top-ranked recruiting classes, and more field storming. It reflects the passion of SEC football, and that's the great selling point of SEC football. It matters so much. It matters so much that less storm the field. It means that much. We're willing to risk a goalpost falling on our head to run onto the field and celebrate the victory. So, and I'm sure some conspiracy theorists will say, well, if they stop us from storming the field, then what's next? Will they say we can't tailgate? If somebody drinks too much at a tailgate gathering and they trip and fall, hit their head and have a concussion, ooh, better eliminate tailgating. Somebody could get hurt. That's the extreme reaction to it. But there are always conspiracy theorists at every level. Yeah, it's a tricky situation, but man, to take away a home football game, conference game, that matters. The mere thought just terrifies coaches. You know that.
Oh, and some school administrators as well. I think they would rather build a moat and fill it with gators around the field and say, you want to storm the field, do so at your own risk. Like, that'll be quite a scene. But to get rid of a home game? Oh, no, I'm not voting for that. Yeah, sure, we'll build a trench and fill it full of dangerous reptiles and try to keep fans off the field that way before we're going to get rid of a home game. I think it's going to be a hard pass. I don't know what the solution is here. I think it was an uphill battle to really tighten the screws on some of these field stormings and court stormings, because what they have now is a fine system that clearly doesn't work. I mean, you think fans in the stands are going to stop themselves from storming the field because they know, school's going to get fined if I storm the field? Well, they don't care about that, and frankly, neither do the schools. I mean, Tennessee last year sort of made a mockery of the rules. The system president, Randy Boyd, was recorded in a video saying, we'll do this every year. We'll pay this fine every year. And athletic director Danny White turned it into an opportunity to have a GoFundMe fundraiser to replace the goalposts, the cost of replacing the goalposts.
There's a liability issue to consider here, too. I guess I like your idea of a moat with alligators. I really like that. LSU could transport its tiger mascot from that palace of a habitat it has, put him in the corner of the stadium briefly in a cage. We're not going to make him suffer, and announce over the PA that if LSU wins the game, Mike will be turned loose to roam the field. I think that would discourage even the least sober of the student body or people who wanted to celebrate a win.
John, let's say you're the athletic director of Let's go with South Carolina. You're the South Carolina athletic director, and this, which is actually Ray Tanner, and I don't know what Ray Tanner's thinking is on this, but in this hypothetical, you're South Carolina's athletic director, and this proposal is put in front of you. You can vote to try to curtail field and court stormings by saying, if a team's home fans storm the field and their school officials are unable to keep fans off the field, well, then 2 years from now, when they're supposed to play that game again, that home game becomes a road game. Would you be in favor of that? Would you vote yes for that? Or are you saying, nah, let's come up with something else?
I would say let's come up with something else, because if I'm the AD at South Carolina, I want to win a game that's worth storming the field for or storming the court for. When was the last time South Carolina won the SEC championship? Never. Yeah,
the next time will be the first time.
Next time Clemson will be the first year. Time. You want to celebrate that win. So you take your chances, and you don't want to be penalized at home game for it.
All right. Well, we'll see where it goes. Might get some more information on that, perhaps at SEC spring meetings, which will occur in about a month's time in Destin, when all the chancellors and athletics directors gather down there. Thanks for listening to this edition of SEC Football Unfiltered.